Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI reflects on the three parables of mercy and asks the faithful to accompany him with prayer when he travels to the United Kingdom later this week. The former abbot of Ampleforth Abbey and College in Yorkshire explains why the issue of Catholic education in England is so high on the Pope's agenda. And Thou Shalt Not Kill, Father Jim Brand examines commandment number 5. Pope Benedict XVI assures us that, despite our faults, God still loves us. The Pope pronounced these words on Sunday during a reflection on the three parables of mercy before praying the midday Angelus with the crowds gathered at the papal summer residence in Castel Gandolfo. And as Lydia O'Kane reports, he's also asking the faithful to accompany him with prayer when he travels to the United Kingdom later this week.
How can we not open our hearts to the certainty that, while we are sinners, we are loved by God? That was the question Pope Benedict posed to the many hundreds of people gathered in the courtyard of the papal summer residence at Castel Gandolfo, where he commented on the Gospel and the three parables of mercy.
In today's Gospel, Jesus speaks of the rejoicing in heaven which accompanies the return of sinners to the house of the Father.
Focusing in particular on the prodigal son, Pope Benedict XVI recalled that God the Father never tires of coming to meet us. He always travels first to the road that separates us from him. The repentance of the son who faces an inner pilgrimage to return home to himself and his Father, said the Pope, is the measure of faith and with it a return to the truth. Then, continued the Holy Father, when the elder son is angered by the festive reception given to his brother, it is the father who reminds him, "You are always with me, but you had to celebrate because your brother was lost and now is found." Only faith, Pope Benedict XVI concluded, can transform selfishness into joy and renew good relationships with others and with God. After reciting the Angelus prayer, the Pope greeted the many pilgrims who had gathered, and the Pope could also be heard and seen on giant TV screens by thousands of people in St. Peter's Square.
I welcome all the English-speaking pilgrims, especially the bishops taking part in the ecumenical meeting sponsored by the Focolare Movement. I also greet the young people of the Don Bosco Oratory from Victoria, Gozo, Malta. And the friends of the John Paul II Foundation from Saudi Arabia. I thank the members of the parish choir from Slovenia for the praise of God in song.
The Pope also asked the faithful to accompany him in prayer on the visit he will make to the United Kingdom, where he will beatify Cardinal John Henry Newman. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for that report. As Lydia was mentioning, Pope Benedict is preparing to travel to the United Kingdom later this week. He's due to leave Rome on Thursday morning, returning on Sunday evening, for a visit which is dense with events. One of the highlights of this papal visit, Benedict's first to the UK since the beginning of his pontificate, is expected to be the beatification of Cardinal John Henry Newman. But first, the Pope's schedule takes him to Edinburgh in Scotland, where, upon his arrival on Thursday, he will meet with Queen Elizabeth II and with other state authorities. In the evening, Benedict XVI will travel to London, and on Friday he will give an address to leaders from the world of Catholic education. He will meet with leaders of other religions and pay a special courtesy visit to the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. On Saturday, the Pope is scheduled to meet with Prime Minister David Cameron and other government leaders and then celebrate Mass in Westminster Cathedral. As I already mentioned, Pope Benedict XVI will beatify Cardinal John Henry Newman in Coughton Park of Rednal in Birmingham on Sunday morning. He's due to conclude his visit with a meeting with the bishops of Scotland, England and Wales. The programme, of which I've mentioned only some of the events, is very, very full. But one of the things that stands out is the time Pope Benedict has chosen to dedicate to the world of Catholic education. Why? I asked my friend Benedictine Abbot Timothy Wright, former abbot of Ampleforth Abbey and College in Yorkshire, one of the most prestigious Catholic schools in the UK. Why is Catholic education in England so high on the Pope's agenda? And what's so special about Catholic education in England anyway?
Catholic education in England is different in many ways from other parts of Europe. First of all is that the Church, though not numerically particularly strong, has, as they say, punched above its weight in terms of education. For many, many decades now, ever since the Second World War, when the new system was set up, but even before that, there were many orders of brothers, teaching sisters, teaching priests, who were encouraged to set up schools because the early bishops in the Restoration, from the Restoration of the Hierarchy in 1850, were very keen that young men and young women in Britain had a Catholic education. So there were a lot of local parish schools, primary level, secondary level. Over the years, these schools, in many cases, have produced high-quality education recognised throughout the land, and they are a rich inheritance of our forebears, many of the people coming from Ireland, of orders of brothers and sisters, but also from local vocations within Britain itself.
But, Father Timothy says, things have changed throughout the years.
When I was a young man in the 50s, there were a lot of Catholic independent schools. There are now very few. But alongside that, there are now a huge number of Catholic schools which are what we call in partnership with the state. They are state schools with Catholic governance, Catholic input and Catholic control in partnership with the state. They're largely funded by the state. Many of them grew up out of religious orders, where the religious are no longer able to run them. They're now lay schools. Some were set up by diocese education committees. And some of them are very formidable centres of good education. And when asked the question why, I think the reasons are quite simple. One is that they have a reputation for excellent teachers, men and women who are dedicated teachers and dedicated to Catholic education. Secondly, they're also well-funded. The state has been very generous, and the governors of such schools have been imaginative in using what funds are available to good use, to build up good facilities. Thirdly, the ethos of a Catholic school is one that believes in good quality teaching, good quality discipline, good quality care for pupils from when they start in nursery through to their finishing perhaps at the end of sixth form, that's 18 plus. So they have built up a formidable reputation. So, for example, there are many, at one end of the scale, many primary schools in London which have such a good reputation that basically there are too many applicants for the places.
Do you have to be Catholic to apply?
No, not at all. The position is basically that every state school will have a so-called recognised catchment area, that is recognised by the local education authority. Although you have a Ministry of Education, a lot of the organisation of schools is delegated to the local education authority in the city or in the area, county, where the school is. And one of the negotiations that is done early on, if you're establishing a new school, is precisely what is the catchment area. And out of the definition of the catchment area, you then develop a criteria for admission. In some of the less Catholic areas, you will often find there are many Christians of other denominations, and perhaps even parents without any religious background, perhaps Muslims, perhaps Jewish, etc.
In search of academic excellence, I presume.
Partly that, partly recognising that it's the best school in the area, possibly in their view, and therefore suits their needs. Partly preserving a spiritual religious tradition, which is maybe not be identical for what their needs is, but is something that they can relate to. I mean, there are not a huge number of Muslim schools in Britain, and therefore in many areas Muslims may well go seek admission to a Catholic school. Likewise with Jewish schools. Likewise, there are many Anglicans who would prefer to go to the local Catholic school than to a purely state-run school, which is one which has no religious background. But the Catholic Church is not the only organisation which runs schools in partnership with the state in Britain. The Jewish organisations do, Muslims do, Methodists do, and Anglicans certainly do. But the Catholics have put a lot of effort into theirs, and as I said at the start, there are more of them than perhaps the number of Catholics in the country would suggest. So within the Catholic community, then, there are a number of people who are highly qualified educationists, both on the administrative level, on the teaching level, on the managerial level, on the curriculum level, on the ability of teaching. And there are also colleges for the training of Catholic teachers. St Mary's University Twickenham, which used to be St Mary's Strawberry Hill, was founded as a college for the training of Catholic teachers. So they're not exclusive, and nor do they, as they're not allowed to, force religion at people. And my own experience in religious studies and religious education is that the number of people who are qualified to teach theology, teach religious studies, is now considerable across the range, but the schools which are likely to give it a priority are religious schools, whether they be Muslim or Christian, and particularly, of course, the Catholic schools. But they're not unique in that. And England is slightly different to most other countries in the world because we have public examinations for all pupils at the age of 16 and at the age of 18. And at both levels, one option is to do an academic course in religious studies. So you can get what they call a general certificate of secondary education in religious studies alongside English and history and maths and physics and biology. Likewise, you can do the same at what they call now A2 levels and AS levels, which are the sixth form exams, alongside the same subjects, perhaps even a wider options. So at that level, the English system, and I distinguish it a little bit from the Scottish system, which is different, but it's similar in Wales, similar in Northern Ireland, allows, therefore, for the academic treatment of moral, doctrinal, philosophical issues related to religion. And in that sense, a Catholic school, which would probably make religious studies a requirement at 16 plus, one would find that the pupils who take that course would be better informed about religious, moral, doctrinal issues than those who've not done it. That's not to say that they are theologians, but it does say that they have at least had some basic academic grounding. And of course, one does draw the distinction because within a Catholic school, there is the curriculum based around the teaching of religious studies, which is a compulsory subject in all schools for some time each week. Well, in a Catholic school and in other religious schools, it will be given a bit more time on the curriculum, and especially once you get it into examinations for 16 plus and 18 plus. But in addition to that, in a Catholic school, as I'm sure in a Jewish school and a Muslim school, there would be also a sense of the pastoral care. And by the pastoral care, I use that as a broad brush description of time that is available for prayer groups, for lectio groups, studying, reflecting on the Bible, for mass in a school, which will be done more informally with groups, possibly once a week only, something like that. But it introduces into the school, alongside the assembly, alongside other optional groups, the possibility of doing quite a wide variety of both liturgical, practical, spiritual things, which help, again, in the formation of the person, in their understanding of faith, its practical effects in life, how it can be lived, and the way it can enrich a person's self-understanding and his relationship with God. That means that in most Catholic schools, certainly at secondary level, you will have not just a religious studies department with a head of religious studies qualified to teach theology, religious studies throughout the school, but you will also have a chaplaincy team where people can go with trouble or people can go and pray or people learn to worship, etc. And sometimes at the sixth form level, they will provide also a room for prayer for if there's a significant Muslim community in the school, they will provide a room for Muslims to pray and for other Christian groups to have their services, their type of thing. So there's an awful lot of work going on and has been achieved over the last 40 or 50 years in developing a very distinctive and very important Catholic ethos in the primary, secondary schools and sixth form colleges, which the church has ultimate responsibility for. There are relatively few religious compared to 30, 40 years ago in these schools, but there is a very highly qualified group of laymen and women who are professional teachers, professional as chaplains and as guides and support for these schools, and the best are among the best in the country by a long way.
Obviously, Father Timothy points out, standards do vary, just as people do.
That means that in most Catholic schools, certainly at secondary level, you will have not just a religious studies department with a head of religious studies qualified to teach theology, religious studies throughout the school, but you will also have a chaplaincy team where people can go with trouble or people can go and pray or people learn to worship, etc. And sometimes at the sixth form level, they will provide also a room for prayer for if there's a significant Muslim community in the school, they will provide a room for Muslims to pray and for other Christian groups to have their services, their type of thing. So there's an awful lot of work going on and has been achieved over the last 40 or 50 years in developing a very distinctive and very important Catholic ethos in the primary, secondary schools and sixth form colleges, which the church has ultimate responsibility for. There are relatively few religious compared to 30, 40 years ago in these schools, but there is a very highly qualified group of laymen and women who are professional teachers, professional as chaplains and as guides and support for these schools, and the best are among the best in the country by a long way. There are some wonderful people, some young people who come out of our schools, totally committed, live a life of great moral integrity, who are people of prayer, who read their scriptures, will go to mass, take part in their parishes. And there are a larger number, probably, who are occasional members of the church. They will certainly be getting married in church. They will certainly have their children baptized in church. They'll certainly put their children through. But they won't be quite the pillars of the church that perhaps there and might have been expected from the investment in their Catholic education of earlier years suggests. But nevertheless, it's unthinkable that they wouldn't be buried from church and they wouldn't get married in church. So they are Catholics, what I would call on the edge. And there are a few who will abandon the whole thing and say that I'm now a secularist and I've looked at religion and I'm afraid it's not for me. And God never required us, obliged us to go against what we genuinely felt was the truth. And so I do not think that a school should be evaluated on just simply on the number of practicing Catholics it produces. the richness of the British tradition is that it creates the environment for really powerful, academically respectable formation in Catholicism, an understanding of its teaching and ways of praying, way of relating to people. And it's out of that that the later commitment will develop.
So, I said to Father Timothy, you have in fact partially answered my next question. That is, why, do you think, has the Pope chosen to celebrate Catholic education during this very busy visit of his to the United Kingdom?
I think one of the reasons he's chosen to celebrate it is, A, it's a success story. B, I think that the system we have in Britain is distinct from what is found in other countries. And I think that there is something there we can celebrate with a good deal of conviction, because it incorporates not just part of the church. The people who are involved in Catholic education come from all sectors of Britain, lay, men and women, religious, priests, sisters, and it touches the heart of everyone's life, because education is your most precious formation. If you don't have a good education system, then where is it that you're going to be able to teach your values, encourage your moral behaviour? Because if the idea of attending, for example, a parish school alongside your mainstream education may be fine in the younger years, but it will be more difficult, except for a very committed minority. By having a whole range of Catholic schools where all this is done partly in the ethos of the school, partly in the leadership of the school, partly in the pastoral provision in the school, but most also in the academic excellence of its teaching of theology and religious studies. To have all that is something really, truly to be celebrated. And my little travels around the world, there aren't many places that have this close link where this religious education is something that the state in Britain holds in with great value. And the little experience I have working with national boards, in, for example, in the development of syllabuses for the GCSE in the 1970s and 80s, and indeed syllabuses for A-level as they existed, my little experience there is that the numbers now doing these courses has gone up. I mean, particularly at A2 level, I was amazed at seeing that perhaps a 50% increase, which everyone else is predicting would be a decrease. You know, who's interested in studying religion? The fact is that religion is one of the most important and the most challenging elements in anyone's education. And in a sense, the better it's taught, the more likely it is that the other elements of education, the other subjects, particularly the scientific ones, the mathematical ones, the linguistic ones, the cultural ones, the classics, all that fits into an integrated whole if the religious studies part of it is taught well and is shown to be the framework in which these other subjects can be taught, learnt, challenged alongside.
So, true to the academic that he is, Pope Benedict obviously recognises the value of all this.
Of course, and he will be admiring, I would imagine, a lot that is being done and a lot that has been done, because there aren't many countries where at 16 plus you can have a syllabus which is by and large a Catholic syllabus. It's not a Catholic syllabus in a restricted sense, because there are Muslim syllabuses, Jewish syllabuses, etc., because every syllabus available has to be open to anyone of any faith or no faith. But nevertheless, a Catholic syllabus enables issues particular to the Catholic tradition of Christianity, which can be taught and taught well. And all these syllabuses, whether it's 16 plus or 18 plus or even younger, do not presume commitment. That's the big issue. They presume people who are interested, and the way it is taught, hopefully, will bring commitment. But at the end of the day, it's not the commitment that's important, it's the understanding. Because out of the understanding, the decision can be made as to whether to follow it or not. And that is the value of a Catholic education, where this is integrated into the academic life and not just in the chaplaincy life.
That was Benedictine Abbot Timothy Wright, former abbot of Ampleforth Abbey and College in Yorkshire. And now Father Jim Brand reflects on all the implications of the fifth commandment, "Thou shalt not kill."
Hello, my name is Father Jim, and at the moment I'm thinking of some of the commandments that God has given us. I see the commandments as the house rules of heaven. They're good for us because they're good for God. And all the commandments are different ways of trying to say the same thing, how to be like God. I mentioned before, I think, that if in this life we've learnt the three words you and I, we will have learnt the family language of the Trinity, Father and Son. And when we reach heaven, we won't have to go to a school of languages called purgatory to learn the family language. Well, if we've managed to learn the commandments, when we reach heaven, we'll feel at home and won't have to go to a reformatory school called purgatory to learn manners. Now, there are over 600 commandments in the Old Testament, and these are all ways of trying to say the same thing, how to become like God, like Father, like sons and daughters. So I'm going to look now at the fifth commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." Our Lord said, "I came that they may have life and have it to the full." And if we're going to be his brothers and sisters, it's worth asking ourselves, are we life givers? When I was a child, I thought, no, fifth commandment, haven't murdered anyone this week, next. Or somebody might say, yes, I've been to confession, murdered my granny last week, haven't done any this week, next. It's not so much have I killed anyone directly, but am I a life giver? There are ways of putting people into decline very easily. Even if you don't kill them off immediately, you can help them deteriorate. Somebody cracks a joke, I crack a better one. That's you cut down to size. Somebody says they ran the mile in 4 minutes, and I say I ran it in three. Well, if you could see my shape, you know that was a lie for a start. We're very good at undermining people, squashing them, demeaning them, and not being life givers. So we have to say to ourselves, when I go by, do people feel better or do they feel worse? Do I pass them so quickly, like a fast motorboat, that they all feel seasick in my wake? Do I run so fast in life that I leave everyone behind and make them feel like slow coaches? Do I flaunt myself with my brilliance in front of people and make them feel stupid? Our Lord washed people's feet. He approached them from the feet upwards so that they would feel that they're standing tall. O Lord, teach me to be a life giver by complimenting people, as I mentioned in the Annunciation, by recognizing them, by respecting them. And you find that some people who went round all rolled up like a hedgehog suddenly start unfolding themselves and aware of their dignity. Amen.
Laudetur Jesus Christus.